We're all set. The recording has started.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. And thank you, everybody, for joining us for the follow-up call today. Again, my name is Jennifer Nolte, and I am with the National Association of Community Health Centers. My role is as Director of Innovative Primary Care, and I work within the PCA and Network Relations Department. So we had a really, you know, I hope that last week's webinar really started to give you a good foundation, maybe even to, for those of you who have been part of contracting and what's going on within managed care environment over the last number of years in Pennsylvania outside of expanding Medicaid, that you were very, you know, at least it gave you maybe a little bit more information and then brought you to hopefully start to evaluate some things and maybe even start to provoke some questions even more so than maybe you had before. And it's always a good thing. And one of the things that I always say usually in when I'm doing presentations, whether it be in person or over the phone or in webinars, is that, you know, we're not supposed to have all the answers. We are not supposed to, even if we've had a number of years of experience in this realm, we're not supposed to, you know it all. So one of my, I think I might have even, I'm not sure if I mentioned it to this group last week, but, you know, my personal philosophy is the only dumb question is one not asked, because normally if somebody has a question, even as maybe not relevant, or sometimes, you know, we're thinking it, and it's the person who actually says it. So, you know, I really hope that we wanted to have this as more of a dialogue for everyone. And so I did not prepare any formal slides, but I did just want to recap, you know, what we were talking about last week. And then there were a few questions that were forwarded on to me, and then really open it up for what you wanted to talk about. The one thing that I thought about after the webinar last week, and again, for those of you who were able to be on last week, I really appreciate you being able to do that. And if you weren't, I hope that you were able to at least maybe view the slides. And what one of the things is that when we're talking about credentialing and we're talking about claims payments, a lot of times, and especially this happens within with providers, or if you're new in credentialing, if it's a new MCO and they're credentialing you, you know, what happens within those time periods, you know, if it's 60 days or, you know, whatever that amount of time is that you're not considered, or that provider is not considered a provider within the actual network, what happens and can you pay for those claims? Depending on the managed care organization, that's technically normally their own call. That's their, you know, the it's interesting because two of the three organizations that I actually worked for did not allow at the time for patients to technically be seen or treated by providers that were in the credentialing process. They felt it was more of a liability to them and to the patient that if for some reason the provider was not able to be credentialed, and which was very few and far between, but still the possibility existed that it was very difficult to make sure that those payments were justified at the time. But that being said, you know, there are, you know, what I would encourage you to do is to discuss that with the managed care organizations and see what their policy is. And it should be listed. If it's not in the actual contract, it should be listed in their provider manual with their policies and procedures so that you understand exactly what happens within those time periods that there is not a contract, or that provider is not considered a credentialed provider within their network, what happens with those claims, or can patients actually be seen. Some managed care organizations will allow backdated claims. Some will allow other providers, obviously, to see. So it's just one of those things what is up to the managed care organization. So I did want to make sure I discussed that. I also wanted to, I could just jump right into the two questions that I had received, unless we wanted to take it in a different direction, Amanda. I don't know what the best.
I'd say to go ahead and start off with those questions.
Okay, we'll do that. So the first question was about assignment of account reps, and then a follow-up to that was when will we be contacted? So generally speaking, especially in the realm of primary care, when a managed care organization has a contract with you as a provider, they will have, especially as you move into value-based contracts, whether it be generally speaking, what will happen is you, especially if you're new to the organization, they usually have a time period that internally, and it's usually spelled out within their policy manual, is that, you know, when you should be contacted by that provider rep or their network representative or whatever, that whoever that lead liaison is between you and the managed care organization for an orientation. They should be contacting once the contract is signed, that person should be contacting and setting up an orientation with at least the practice manager and any other people that are involved or should be involved in that orientation. And they should be walking through the different aspects of that and different pieces of that, and then they should be letting you know how often we're discussing with you, how often that should happen, and you know and what would work best for you for your locations, or if this practice manager oversees various locations, bringing in the site managers as well, and making sure that everyone understands what's going on. So if you are currently in a arrangement with a managed care organization and you have not heard from anyone, then I always would go back to the person my recommendation would be to go back to the person that you negotiated the contract with. They're the ones that would be responsible for handing that off and making sure that that's followed up on. And making sure that the person is actually doing what they're supposed to do. And again, you know, one of the things that I always have said over the last couple of years being with NAC, when talking to PCA's networks and especially the health centers, is, you know, the managed care organization representatives are there for you. So, you know, each one of them are going to have their own style, but they should also be very flexible in what is needed for your organization. So, you know, if you have a standing monthly meeting or, you know, and having them come in and talk to you, if there's reports that have to be dropped off or have to be looked at and evaluated and they come out on a monthly basis, you know, making sure that you're receiving that information. So, and that, you know, how you want to disseminate that. So if they're not asking the question, but yet you want to be the one to actually receive the information and disseminate it, or you're okay with it being with them disseminating it, but you need the information as well and still have a meeting with them. And especially as we move into the value-based conversations, this becomes even more important. And then the second question is, are all contracts required to have the same minimum timely filing guidance? And if so, does or will this apply to the mental behavioral health payers, CCBH, for example? Technically, yes, they should have, you know, with that organization, a clean claim is supposed to be, quote-unquote, adjudicated. And when I say adjudicated means paid and or denied. So even though, you know, we have to, and that's one thing I when we talked about the lingo and the culture and the language, we want to make sure that we get that, you know, but when you're talking about claims and you're talking about timely filing, as long as everything is in place, then, and everything is quote-unquote clean, then yes, they should all be following the minimum standards, unless there's something off the wall, but most of the time they all have to have a minimum amount of time. Now, depending upon the product line, so if it's primary care versus mental health, they may change those, they may lessen those timely filing timelines. And it's very, very important, and as we spoke of last week, is that if there are changes going to happen, whether they're in the favor of the provider or not, there has to be a minimum amount of time, and then you have to, you know, if you can in any way, be able to say to them, I would, you know, I want for the right of first refusal. I don't want to just be assumed, unless I say no, that I'm going to accept this. You know, I would definitely, with things like when they're taking the amount of time from maybe 180 days down to 90 or 60 or 45, you know, that can pose a really big stressor on you, the provider. So it's very important that they, the MCO, understand those types of timelines are not, you know, they're doing it for the masses. So they're looking at it from what's their average claims payment, and most of the time their clean claims payment or their clean claim adjudication is going to run about 7 business days or even 7 calendar days. So to them, 45 days is more than enough time. But from the individual provider, that can be a stress. And especially with what you as, you know, what's going on in your individual world and communities, you have to be able to manage that effectively. So that's why it's very important when changes are made that you have the ability to evaluate them. First of all, you have to make sure you get the correct notification. And then secondly, you also have to be able to have the ability to either say yes or no and not just be assumed unless you say something, because then that can put you in a very tight or difficult situation. So, but generally, yes, go ahead.
Hi, this is Sherry. Just a couple of points on the three issues that you've addressed. On the provider credentialing, I just want everyone to be alert and aware that DHS did create a benchmark in the 2016 contract, and that's 60 days. And they also are requiring that the credentialing, MCO credentialing, occurs concurrently with the Medicaid Promise application. We included the exact language from the contract from DHS in last week's newsletter, so you have that. But be aware that there was no benchmark before. There was no requirement for concurrent, so what would happen is you had to wait to even begin the MCO process until you had a promise number. Now DHS is saying, no MCO, you can't make them wait. You can't finish it until you promise, but you can't make them wait to start it.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing with assignment of an account rep, if you are having trouble getting a response from an individual MCO, another option is to let us know. We have worked hard to have relationships with all of the MCOs, and we'll make sure that senior leadership is aware that you're having a challenge and that you get a response. And with the timely filing, I know that for many health centers, they've been able to negotiate that number. A lot of the standard MCO agreements, when they're presented to you, have 90-day clauses in, which for some health centers is a challenge. and most health centers have been able to extend that, to get that extended to 180.
Great, thank you. Are there any questions or comments from the audience, especially around the value-based conversation? You know, there's so much that we can dive into. It's just understanding where people are and what's the thing that keeps you up at night. I guess that's the question when we're talking about the value-based conversation, especially what's keeping you up at night, or as new health plans are entering into the market that we haven't had, you haven't had experience with, what are those things that...
Hi, good afternoon. Good morning, I'm sorry. This is Odessa with La Comunidad Hispana. One of the questions that most concerns me with the new insurance companies that are entering the arena is the credentialing process as far as becoming newly credentialed with these companies. When I am reading over the contracts and the agreements, they are without fee schedules. So it is almost as if we are expected to sign the contracts without ever knowing what types of fees that we are going to be expecting.
That's a very good point, because what's happened over the last number of years is that as what happens is the Medicare payment system is the baseline for all payments within the MCOs. So they use Medicare, and they should be referencing that in the reimbursement language within the contract, wherever that's found. And they may say that they pay 100% of Medicare for their Medicare Advantage plan. They may say that they pay 80% for Medicaid, of the Medicare fee schedule for their Medicaid plan, et cetera. But what happens is because MCOs have actually removed the fee schedules from the contract and from all of the paperwork, only because to them it becomes very cumbersome to update those. So the best thing to do is to before signing it, is to say to them, and this also goes back to what we were talking about with the PPS rate and finding out what services are covered under the PPS rate and what services are not, and then what your reimbursement will be for those. So it's actually giving them standard codes that would be applicable to your organization and making sure that they provide back to you what the reimbursement would be for those codes. Because that is, and then understanding or asking them, when do you adjust these codes? Most of the time, it could be after October 1, okay, or it could be January 1st, but that's really depending upon, and I would ask it for each product line, like what they're going to be reimbursing you for. So if they're going to use PPS for the Medicaid plan, but they also have a Medicare plan, well, what is the reimbursement supposed to be for those particular codes to you? Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. So primarily, if I am understanding your answer correctly, I should get probably a clearer or a better understanding of some of our most used codes and see how that they would prepare to pay these codes. Is that
right,
what I'm hearing you say?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
They would be able to give you, especially since they're now going, you know, being responsible for the PPS payment, they should be telling you what are the codes that are part of that PPS, and then what are the things that are outside of that. So you should be able to do a comparison of what is in your system versus what, you know, they're giving you.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. What else is, what are some of the other questions that are out there? What's keeping you up at night?
Jen, I just received a question.
Okay.
The question is, and I've not pre-read, what about the payer's blanket allowance to add and shift products within a plan? Often they are also changing names and payment methodologies, and it's very confusing, hard to track. Often they do not notify you ahead of time. What, if any, repercussions do we have for this?
Yeah, that that is something. That happens. And again, that goes back to the all product clause language, and it becomes, you know, and the contract that was shared with me, you know, in there, one of my biggest questions was it just links two products, Medicaid and Medicare. And within those products that they list, what are the plans or what are the names? You know, usually they would have examples of what those cards would look like. But that's why it's very important from an account representative perspective, or, you know, being able to negotiate out or take out the all products clause to say, you know, or to ask them, what, when you're saying Medicare and Medicaid, what are those products? And then can we negotiate that we have the right of first refusal to not accept those? Because especially if the fee schedule is going to change or is going to be different than what is currently negotiated. So, you know, it can be... But those are things that, yes, definitely can be negotiated and asked for. And it is, and I do totally understand your angst in that, because that is something, especially since the ACA has become more and more confusing. There's products out there that we're not sure of who actually runs them and who oversees them. And that's why it's really, that's why when I explained about having a team approach, it becomes more and more imperative to do that, because maybe, you know, from the higher upper level, it doesn't, not that it doesn't matter, but the impact isn't as great as it is from a patient or the frontline staff perspective.
You know, I'll have a question, folks. Yeah,
no, you're good.
Okay. We're talking up both now, the two new people out here in the western part, and ask about that. We admit to a High Valley hospital, which is a small independent hospital. We've admitted there for 30 years or more. And they both sort of hesitant about saying, yeah, we're going to get it. Well, they say, well, we're working on it. They say every hospital has to negotiate, but not every hospital has to sign up. Any comments about the possibility that some of these small hospitals will not sign up for these products?
When you're talking about smaller hospitals, it's smaller versus the larger. I would say that the smaller hospitals will, 9 times out of 10, would sign up for that, but generally speaking, yes, the hospital contracting can be a very long and laborious process, especially when it's a brand new plan in town, because, you know, they don't want to get burned. Whether they're large or small, they don't want to get burned. And they want to make sure, you know, well, if we bring you on as part of our network, you know, what does that mean? I think using your leverage in that respect is very powerful. To say, you know, this is where we primarily admit, and if you can't obtain a contract with them, you know, this is going to cause us to you know, work with someone that we haven't had the experience with, or but using your leverage to do that and say, we can't commit to a contract with you until we know, or if you have, you know, generally speaking, especially when they're new in an area and they're in a tight time frame, like what's happening in Pennsylvania, they may not have the full contract negotiated, but they should be able to obtain or would obtain a letter of intent or a letter of agreement that would span until they give them, it buys them some time that says that they are negotiating, that they are in the process of signing that contract. So, you know, I definitely would use that in your favor. And, you know, that's totally your, that puts more pressure if you hold back and say, you know, we're not going to sign on until we know that, you know, our patients can be seen and utilize this facility that they've been using for over 30 years. Because that, you know, when you're talking about value-based especially, you're moving, you know, they're moving in that direction, and it's for the patients. So that's why it becomes very imperative that that relationship remains intact. Does that help, or?
Well, basically, that's what we told them. They, the team said, well, send in the contract with sort of that addendum on it or that note on it, and I don't know if you want to do that or not, but.
Yeah, I mean, that's, generally speaking, if you sign a contract and then they execute it, I mean, you can do it with, you know, if you want to have, like they said, like I don't know if it would be an amendment or a condition that this would only be executed, fully executed, at the time that the hospital X is included in the network. I mean, I would just make sure it's very, very clear, very implicit, so that you're not in the network and then they don't have a contract at the end of it.
Yeah.
Jen, this is Sherry again, and just wanted to mention, I know that at least the Centene agreement, because we've seen that, includes the 340B contract pharmacy language that's in the Health Choices contract, and I've had calls from several people about that, about, you know, what do we do? Yeah, obviously, ultimately, the agreement is up to each individual health center. We have not heard back from DHS. We've met with lots of officials in the budget office, with the governor's office, with DHS, and this is not resolved yet. We're trying to keep the pressure on. And one way to do that is to say, you know, we're not willing to sign an agreement while that language is still in. We're willing to have it amended, the contract amended, if it doesn't change and we have to include it in. But right now we're not willing to sign. But that's one option.
Mm-hmm.
Another option is you can sign the agreement with it in with a condition that if it changes, the contract will be amended. I think the first puts a little bit more pressure on.
Yeah, and, I agree.
And that's what you're in. I'm sorry, this is Odessa again with La Comunidad Hispana. That is a contract that we have recently, that we recently received. We will be meeting with Centene on Wednesday the 8th. And within reading that contract, I did notice that they did have the language in there with the 340B. And that was a huge, huge area of ambiguity for me. So I can, you know, sit in that meeting and state that we don't feel comfortable signing with that language in there like that.
Yes, and Centene is well aware of the 340B contract pharmacy issue.
Okay.
They, quote, have offered help. Now, I do know that part of the help is they have a pharmacy product that they think can help resolve the issue for you that allows you to do an in-house pharmacy. I think that we have to be clear, and I was very clear with them that what we're hearing, the length of time to get an in-house pharmacy in place and get the approvals, the average is 16 months. So that is not a short-term solution. You know, if they want to talk to you about their pharmacy solution once you have an established relationship with them at some time in the future, that's one thing. But as far as it addressing the current urgent issue, it is not a solution.
I would totally agree.
Yeah, I think you're well within your right to press back on that provision.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, and that's that. I mean, and then I guess my question would be, in how is it addressed in the current contracts you have? Because you can always use that. If everyone else does not address it at all, or everyone else addresses it in a favorable way that you are comfortable, use that as your leverage point as well to say, this is, you know, we don't sign this, or we don't include this in any other agreements.
Okay.
I mean, that's the other thing.
Okay. Thank you.
I mean, the one thing to keep in mind is that Centene does have familiarity with FQHCs, is very positive in what they talk about in their relationships with the FQHCs, but at the end of the day, all of the MCOs have to really understand what it is that you offer. And that includes, you know, everybody from the top down. And that's why, you know, when even though some of these MCOs have had existing relationships, it's always good to continue bringing them in for things like Health Center Week, or being able to let them know what are the things that are being offered, enabling services, or these types of things. But definitely use your leverage point as far as your existing contracts as well to make sure that, you know, if something similar to this is not addressed in there, it's a lot easier to add something in than to take it out, unless it explicitly says it in there.
Okay. Great information to have. Thank you again.
What I would add is, you know, some of the MCOs are, like some of our health centers, have much more experience with pay-for-performance and value-based arrangements. And even though DHS is requiring them to pay you at PPS, your pay-for-performance or bonus arrangements are to be on top of PPS. So if there are things that you believe that you can do to improve their measures as well as yours, I think most of them are open to those conversations so that you can find ways to get some revenue on top of your PPS payments for the encounter.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, because that should be, and sometimes, and you may already be in arrangements where you're getting a bonus or pay for performance. On top of that, you may not have a contract for those things because the MCO considers them a quote-unquote bonus. But as we move into these value-based conversations and CMS and Medicaid start pushing this to be more of the norm rather than the exception, we should be seeing those contracts. And even if you're not offered one, I would actually ask for information about that, because if you can start to, and we talked about that last week as well, is that if you can at least get information from them and then start to evaluate the data that they're providing, you know, if once you hit a certain threshold, or then using that to say, well, this is really what our data looks like, and looking at the definitions, especially for the areas that have the health center controlled network, and, you know, looking at specific data and can spot trends and have evaluated information on the patient. You know, from an MCO world, they only have the information for those patients on the claims that they receive, whether they're denied or paid. So all adjudicated claims are, or even those claims or those codes that are quote unquote reportable, that don't associate or have a payment associated with them, but are very important to have. All that data is collected by the MCO, but it's only a piece of, you know, what's going on. So technically, when I worked for the MCOs, you know, I was very fortunate in that you look at it from the patient standpoint, you know, the best picture from that of that patient as far as cost and utilization is going to come from the MCO and then from the primary care physician office, because that's going to give probably 80% of the picture of that patient. And it becomes even more relevant with the health centers, because you've had the unique perspective that you have treated patients that have not had insurance in the past, but you have treated them and you have given them information and you've given them treatment and you have given them services that are not necessarily reimbursable, but yet should be. So that's why all these different components, that's what makes you unique, and that's what you should be bringing to the health plans. And they may understand it for one state or one region, but every region within Pennsylvania has their own little idiosyncrasies. And, you know, I know particularly in the Pittsburgh area, you have the area or the counties that surround Pittsburgh, or the Allegheny County, and then you have everything else. When you're in the eastern part of Pennsylvania, you have the northeastern part, you have very urban areas, but then you also have very rural areas. So, you know, all different areas are going to have unique circumstances. So those are the things that we have to bring in and leverage within these, like making sure that they're not trying to just get a network and then figure out everything later. Any other questions or comments?
This is Carla from Delaware Valley. I have a question. For those of us who didn't participate last week, how can we get the slides?
They're available on PAC's website. If you go under the events and meetings, off to the left there's an engagement. The slides are there as well as the recording of the webinar.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Amanda, could you repeat that one time, because with someone going off, the beep cut out the middle of what you said.
Sure. It's actually on PAC's webpage. If you go to the events and meetings tab, on the left-hand side there, there's an In Case You Missed It tab. And the slides are there as well as a recording of the webinar.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi. I do have a question, Jennifer.
Go for it.
Pay for performance. In the past, measures and program requirements in the previous MCO programs were determined in advance by the MCOs. Moving forward, where the health centers have more ability to collaborate with the MCO on how the value-based payments are developed?
It's a great question. I have a clarifying. When you say the health centers being able to collaborate, are you talking across the state, or are you talking can you just be more specific on that piece of it?
Not across the state, but each health center in their region has 3 or 4 MCOs that are dedicated to their region, so they're going to be working mm-hmm. with those payers.
Right. Generally speaking, and Sherry, you can correct me on this,
generally, Pennsylvania has not dictated, but they've used the pay for performance measures and things that are programs from the NCOs, and then they actually went out a couple years ago and said, this is what we want. And there was like, there were measures that were across the board, regardless of who the MCO was, but then there were a few measures that could be adapted, or if they were more important to the MCO, they could do that. I believe there's something similar still in place for that. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, yes, the measure, what the MCOs are being measured on, there's some consistency in that. How they're doing that differs by MCO, and the pay-for-performance program differs by MCO. And
okay.
Some of the MCOs have, for example, Gateway had created an FQHC advisory committee to get input on what made sense as a pay-for-performance program for FQHC. I think, you know, we have to be cautious that because we don't have an IPA or a negotiating structure, that we don't violate law by colluding on negotiation of contracts. But I think that reaching out to MCOs in the region saying, you know, FQHCs are different. Our patient populations are different. Would you be willing to have a conversation about pay-for-performance programs that make sense for the FQHC entity, similar to, and often, and you know this, Jen, putting them in competition with one another is often helpful, but, you know, similar to what Gateway has done may be a reasonable approach.
Right. Yeah, to go back to answering the question, there's what I would add, you should be able to, yes and no is the answer, but basically saying to the MCO, well, why are you including these measures? And then being able to somehow, if you can, coordinate and look at, if you have three or four MCOs in a region and they all have a incentive program, being able to, you know, if you can even use a simple spreadsheet and say, well, out of these three MCOs, these, and they have 10 measures, these eight are consistent across all the MCOs, but we have this little bit that's inconsistent. You know, looking at, number one, the consistent measures that are across all MCOs, are those, how would you rank those? Are those things that are important to you as a health center? Are those things that, from a health center perspective, is a focus? Because, you know, if the Bureau is asking you to now, you know, increase your colorectal cancer screening, is that something that's also important from an MCO perspective? It may not be. But letting them know, so that's why the conversation and the communication has to be, you know, two-way, and saying, well, why are you measuring us on these things? And it may be that the state is requiring that, one. And then number two is, you know, well, these are the things that are, that we're working on because this is important to us and this is why. You know, we're measured annually on our UDS measures and we have to report them and we've been asked. So I'm just, those are some things that, you know, letting them know what you're working on and why, and what, and how you can, you know, what are the things that are actually, that cross each other, and then what are the things that fall out of those. And really being able to say, well, you know, we can't focus on all these measures. Can we pick one that's important? And maybe hopefully you can do that for all of your MCOs.
Jen, I think it merits that some of the comments last week also about how the MCO is looking at attribution of patients to evaluate how you're doing with those performance measures as well.
Right. Exactly. No, I definitely, that is the thing, is that, you know, we talked about attribution and how that is done from a managed care organization, and that's what, that becomes very important to really understand and have it in writing how they are attributing members to you and what patients are included in that, from that population, in those measures. If they're using strictly HEDIS, it's going to be a sub portion of that, but you have to know that if they have 1,000 patients that are included, that have been attributed to you, and you've only been able to see about 40% or 400, how many outside of the 400 are actually included in the incentive? So that's absolutely imperative to understand, number one, how they're attributing patients to you, and then number two, how they're, of those attributed patients, which ones are seen by your practice and which ones are included as part of the incentive, because it becomes very cyclical. And if you focus on the 40% and you're missing the other portion, you know, then that becomes, that can be very, that just becomes an issue. So it's working with them to understand, you know, how are you doing that? It's a very big piece of this. And it's not unusual. One of the things I would recommend is to say back to the MCOs, you know, well, especially if it's a new incentive plan or a new plan in general, and say, well, out of all these patients, who do you want me to focus on? What are the big outliers? You know, generally speaking, it's going to be, you know, a small amount of patients that, you know, from a cost perspective and utilization perspective, that should be worked on and you know, that you can chip away at. But if, so that's why it's just, you know, saying to them, who do you want me to focus on, and what information do you have on them?
And what resources they can provide you to help you focus on the patient, because if you have 1,000 patients and you're only seeing 400, the 600, if you've reached out to them and haven't been able to get them in, the managed care company needs to be able to assist you in that process if they're holding you accountable for the 600 people.
Very good point. Very good point. And that becomes, and again, if you haven't had a person, it goes back to that representative, the account rep that we talked about, or that network representative. That should be part of the questions when, even at the time when you're having the contract negotiations and saying, well, can you spell out what resources you have to assist me, the provider office, with bringing in patients and making sure these patients are, you know, what are all the information that you email to them or send to them, or, you know, how I have information, where do you get the information from? Do you make phone calls? Do you have somebody in the hospital when they're coming into the emergency room and direct them back to their patient, to their primary care office? You know, when they're discharged from a hospital, do you have a representative in there that can help to make an appointment back with me as the provider office? And what do I need to make sure I have? So absolutely, they have resources that, you know, they need to bring, you know, to make that available to you and to understand what it is that you have and how you can work together on that, because that becomes very important.
I think we're at the top of the hour, Jen.
Yeah. I really appreciate everybody's time and attention to this and having this opportunity to actually bring this information to you and to have these conversations. And, you know, we don't have to, you know, we However, you know, if we wanted to circle back or just, you know, send questions just through Sherry's team, if you feel that we should have another call like this in a couple weeks, you know, I think that that's perfectly fine. If there's anything that you need our help with, please don't hesitate to reach out.
Thank you very much, Jen.
Bye.
You're welcome. And good luck with everything. And I look forward to hearing what is going to come out of all of this. So.
So do we.
Well, thank you so very much for this information. It's been very helpful.
I'm glad. Thank you all. And
thank
have a great
you.
Weekend.
All right. You do the same.
Thank
bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye.